Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Meet the next generation of podcast stars with SiriusXM's Listen Next program, presented by State Farm. As part of their mission to help voices be heard, State Farm teamed up with SiriusXM to uplift diverse and emerging creators. Tune in to Stars and Stars with Issa as host Issa Nakazawa dives into birth charts of her celeb guests. This is just the start of a new wave of podcasting. Visit statefarm.com to find out how we can help prepare for your future. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
It's no secret that nearly any mother-daughter relationship can be deeply emotional, supportive, consoling, loving, and of course at times, completely challenging. But how would or could one navigate this most important of bonds with a monarchy in the mix? The pressures of being princess or even queen to add emotional layers into this most complex of connections? In this unique episode, I am joined again by author and royal historian Tracy Borman, who joined me for the Gilded Gentleman's coronation show last year for a look at a few of the most famous examples in British history of royal mothers and daughters and how each influenced the other in their royal relationships. I'm Carl Raymond, the host of the Gilded Gentleman History Podcast, where every 2 weeks we journey into corners light and dark for a look at America's Gilded Age, France's Belle Époque, and England's late Victorian and Edwardian eras. It's an obvious statement that British history has included some truly revolutionary and strong defiant queens in its over 1,000-year history of the monarchy. The recent passing of Queen Elizabeth II, Britain's longest reigning monarch, was a moment to consider her extraordinary shaping of a modern Britain. Until her great-great-granddaughter surpassed her, Queen Victoria held the title as the longest reigning monarch and guided Britain through the 19th century in an age of empire and dramatic expansion. And it's worth taking a look at both Queen Elizabeth II and Queen Victoria as mothers and daughters themselves to add depth to understand their reigns. But perhaps many historians look farther back to Tudor and Elizabethan times, to the reigns of two queens and the complicated influence each had on the other, to see the beginnings of how this most royal role, along with family, duty, and the throne, are all deeply entwined. Elizabeth I took the throne in 1558 upon the death of her half-sister Queen Mary, whose father, Henry VIII, they both had in common. But Elizabeth's mother was Henry VIII's second wife, Anne Boleyn, who died by Henry's order on the scaffold when her daughter Elizabeth was only 3 years old. Despite the fact that Elizabeth I barely knew her mother, the effect Anne had on Elizabeth I's life was profound and lifelong. And the effect that her infant daughter had on Anne Boleyn herself affected her life as a queen, a royal wife, and a royal mother. While we will be looking at the complexities of the mother-daughter relationships between Queen Victoria and her mother, the Duchess of Kent, and between Queen Elizabeth II and her mother, the former Lady Elizabeth Bowes Lyon, we will concentrate in this episode on the fascinating connection between mother and daughter, Anne Boleyn, and Queen Elizabeth I. My guest today, historian Tracy Borman, has just written a detailed and deeply absorbing chronicle of this most unique mother-daughter relationship, Anne Boleyn and Elizabeth I, the mother and daughter who forever changed British history. I am so deeply honored to have Tracy join me once again on The Gilded Gentleman. Dr. Tracy Borman is a best-selling author, historian, and broadcaster specializing in the Tudor period. Her books include Elizabeth's Women, Thomas Cromwell, The Private Lives of the Tudors, and Crown and Scepter, A New History of the British Monarchy from William the Conqueror to Charles III. She has also written a fiction trilogy, The King's Witch, based in the court of James I. Her latest nonfiction book is Anne Boleyn and Elizabeth I, The Mother and Daughter Who Changed History. Tracy is also Joint Chief Curator of Historic Royal Palaces and Chief Executive of the Heritage Education Trust. Tracy appears regularly on television, radio, and on podcasts, including appearances on Channel 5 and the Smithsonian Channel as a historical commentator. Her latest nonfiction book, published to great acclaim in both Britain and America, is Anne Boleyn and Elizabeth I, The Mother and Daughter Who Changed History, which serves as the basis for our discussion today. Tracy joined me just about a year ago as my guest for the Coronation Show. Tracy, I am so honored and excited and grateful to welcome you back to the Gilded Gentleman.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Carl. I've been so looking forward to this. And we had such a great chat last time, and I know that's going to be the case today. So thanks for having me back.
Oh, it is such an honor. And there's so much more to talk about.
There is.
So, Tracy, I'm so excited to just jump into the middle of all of this here. So there's been so much written about both Anne Boleyn and Elizabeth I, which includes extensive previous work of your own.
Yeah.
What made you decide to write this? And what was the new angle? What is the new perspective? And how did you get that?
So they're two of my favorite women in history. And I'm not alone in that. They're hugely popular, enigmatic, captivating figures, Anne Boleyn and her daughter Elizabeth. But this book really has been a slow burner, I have to say, because I first got the idea back in, 2007, when I was writing Elizabeth's Women about all of the female influences surrounding Elizabeth I. Now, there were about 50 of those women I covered in that book, and Anne Boleyn was the first of them, but I could only give her a chapter. But it always felt like the tip of the iceberg, what I'd found out about these two, and I always, always wanted to go back and just research their relationship on its own, give it a whole book if there was enough to say. And it took me all this time, but it was actually thanks to a rehang of pictures at Hampton Court, where I work part of the time, that I actually got on and did it. So 3 years ago, I was walking along the Haunted Gallery. What a great name for a gallery at Hampton Court. And I noticed that the pictures had been reorganized. And there, for the first time, Anne Boleyn was next to her daughter Elizabeth. And I thought, that's it. It's a sign. I need to go back and write this book. Not knowing if there'd be enough material, but I'm pleased to say there was enough for about three books. It's unbelievable, their story. So it's been a joy.
You know, obviously, in preparation for this show, I read the book and I've read much of your work. And I was just so struck and astonished once again by the level of detail and new detail and the way that you craft it into a narrative. I mean, this is a story and you just flesh it out with all sorts of details. So we'll get into a few of these details in our conversation, but I thought we'd start, and this was fascinating to me. I think it's worth spending a few minutes actually setting up Anne Boleyn and who she was and where she came from, because that sort of sets up and goes down the line and influences her daughter. So it seems that so much of this story actually perhaps began with the ambitions of the Boleyn family, particularly Anne's father, Thomas. So can you talk a little bit about who the Boleyns were and how their goals and maybe even their psychology shaped the young Anne?
I certainly can. So Thomas Boleyn, Anne's father, he was a very ambitious courtier in the reign of Henry VIII. He was successful as well. He'd sort of gradually risen through the ranks. Henry loved him, showered promotions on him. He was first and foremost a diplomat, often going abroad on Henry's service. Traditionally, Thomas Boleyn has been seen as this quite cutthroat man who pushed forward his three children, no matter the risks. to further the family's ambitions. So Anne had two siblings, Mary and George, and they all had varying careers at court. But actually, there's not a lot of evidence that Thomas was quite such a character. And actually, I think, like any loving father, he wanted the best for his children. He recognised Anne's promise early on. She's definitely the most intelligent of the three children. But the evidence, I think, suggests that he was trying to protect her from Henry VIII. It wasn't some kind of predetermined plan that his daughter was going to be pushed into the limelight. Henry would fall in love with her and the Boleyns would enjoy untold power and riches when Anne became queen. There's no evidence that was ever the case. But nevertheless, the Boleyns were on the map. They were a family on the rise. And so Thomas was able to secure all these different opportunities for Anne, both in England and abroad. And eventually, she would be propelled into the orbit of England's most famous king, most notorious king, Henry VIII.
Now, what I think is fascinating about that is Anne really had a couple of really, truly extraordinary moments in her young life when so much was set in motion and she was sent away to two different courts in Europe, first in the Netherlands and then on to France. Can you talk about those experiences, why she was sent there, what happened to her, and how they really affected and shaped her?
I mean, what an opportunity this first one was. So I mentioned that her father, Thomas, was a diplomat, and he had recently been in the Netherlands making a new treaty between England and the Netherlands. And he'd become very friendly with the regent, Margaret of Austria, who was a real matriarch. You know, she was quite an extraordinary woman. And he persuaded Margaret to accept his daughter Anne into her court, kind of on a, I don't know, we would call it a gap year in England. You know, you kind of spend a year abroad in between other things. But Anne was only 12, probably. We don't know for sure Anne's birth date, but she was probably about 12 when she went to the Netherlands. And what a contrast to being in the countryside of Kent, southeast England, quite a remote part of the country. And suddenly here she is in the Netherlands, one of the most cultured courts in Europe. And she gets on very well with Margaret, who calls her La Petite Boulin, or the Little Boleyn, because Anne isn't very tall at this stage, and introduces her to all sorts of different cultures and ideas, art, artists, literary figures. And it's such an education for Anne. But actually, she doesn't stay there perhaps as long as her father had envisaged. And that's thanks to Henry VIII, because he falls out with the Netherlands then and he changes allegiances. And he makes a new treaty with France. And that's why Anne is then transferred to the French court, serving in the household first of Henry VIII's sister Mary, who for a very short time is the consort of the King of France. Then Louis, the King, dies. He's succeeded by Francis I, and Anne enters the service of Francis's wife, Claude. And she remains in France for several years. And I think this is really the making of Anne Boleyn. She's a Francophile for the rest of her life. She probably spoke with a bit of a French accent. She dressed in French styles, and she was absorbing all of these quite radical ideas in the French court. She was great friends with Marguerite of Navarre, the French king's sister, who was quite outspoken in her views and her criticism of the Roman Catholic Church. And that's something that Anne would become known for herself when she came to England. So these experiences in first the Netherlands, then in France, really shaped Anne Boleyn. And she stood apart from every other woman in the English court when she finally returned there in 1522.
Now, there's an aspect of this that you just mentioned that I'd really like to follow up on and know more about this. And that was Anne's developing passion for religious reform, particularly because that was something important for her daughter, Elizabeth I, and her reign as well. So can you talk a little bit about the state of religion in England in young Anne's time and what influence she wanted to have on that?
Yeah, and I'm so pleased you mentioned this, Carl, because this was one of the greatest discoveries for me personally, not necessarily for history, but in writing this book, just how much influence Anne had in the Reformation. And it wasn't just because Henry wanted an annulment and that sparked the Reformation. Anne was pushing forward these radical religious ideas. And so, in essence, what she became inspired by in France was the need to reform the Roman Catholic Church. It was rife with corruption. There was a notorious sale of indulgences, which made quite a profit. And an indulgence was really a piece of paper you would buy to lessen your time in purgatory. And it was, as you can imagine, a nice little earner for the Roman Catholic Church, but it was quite an abusive system, really. And likewise, the sale of relics, you know, parts of the body of Christ and all of that, all fake. And Anne was part of a growing number of critics of this. And also, what she was putting forward is that people should have the right to a personal relationship with God. They should be able to read the Bible in English, not in Latin. They should hear church services in English. They should have their own relationship with God that didn't depend on Latin-speaking priests as it had for centuries. These were really quite radical ideas, bordering on heresy. So Anne was taking risks for her faith, but you know, she was spurred on very much by Marguerite of Navarre, and she was fired up with these ideas by the time she returned to England, several years after, well, almost a decade after first leaving it. Now, England then was still a Roman Catholic country. We were obedient to the Pope in Rome, but these reformist ideas were starting to infiltrate the country. So Anne really transformed them from being this quiet minority into being the thing that would drive all change, would transform everything in England. You know, there would be a religious revolution. Thanks, I think, largely to Anne Boleyn, and then, of course, to her daughter, Elizabeth.
And with that, Tracy and I are going to take a brief break, but we'll be back to continue the story.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night. And building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
And we're back. I'm Carl Raymond, host of the Gilded Gentleman History Podcast. And today I'm with author and royal historian Tracy Borman, and we are looking at royal mothers and daughters. So, Tracy, let's move on to the moment where Anne actually enters Henry VIII's court. How did that actually happen? And once she arrived, how was she actually perceived at court?
Yeah, so her father, Thomas, he's always one step ahead of the game. And so while Anne is still in France, Thomas has lined her up a position at Henry's court, and she's serving in the household of Henry's first and only wife at that time, Catherine of Aragon. So what could possibly go wrong, really? Anne Boleyn enters the court, and she's the sort of woman you notice when she walks into a room. She has this unique style. As I mentioned, she brings sort of French fashions over to England, particularly the French hood that she's famous for, speaks with a French accent. But she has literally a je ne sais quoi, this enigmatic quality, this charisma. And so even though all of the contemporary writers at the time point out, and they're at pains to point out, she's not beautiful. You know, she's not conventionally beautiful. She's got dark hair when blonde hair is more favoured. Her bosom is not much raised, as they said. Take from that what you will. But she's irresistible because she's so self-confident. She has this kind of allure that draws men to her. But while she kind of takes Henry's court by storm, it's not love at first sight for Henry. And if we shatter any myths in this podcast, I'd like it to be that one, because it's seen as that. Oh, Henry sees her, he's head over heels in love, he can't wait to get rid of Catherine of Aragon. It takes Henry 4 years to notice Anne Boleyn, but that's not exactly a kind of instant hit. But he does make up for lost time. And rapidly, his interest in Anne becomes an all-consuming obsession. And that is really the beginning of Anne's story as we know it from the year 1526, when she's first mentioned as the king's inamorata, his new love interest. And the rest is history.
Well, I think this is so interesting. And one of the things that I picked up from your book, which I just did not know, is that so apparently Anne's sister Mary was actually the king's mistress for a period of time, too. Gosh, this gets very tangled. Can you comment on that?
Yes, you're right. Henry kept it in the family. In fact, there were rumors that he'd also had an affair with Anne and Mary's mother, Elizabeth, although he always strenuously denied that. But yes, Mary Boleyn had also served in the French court. She had become the mistress of the French king, who was Henry's greatest rival. So, of course, Henry's going to go on better, bring Mary back so that she's no longer in his service. And she's going to be his mistress now. And then he ups the ante by trying to make her sister Anne his mistress as well. But Anne doesn't go the same way as her sister. And I think this is probably Mary Boleyn's greatest gift to Anne in a way, in that she has proved what can go wrong if you agree too readily to be the mistress of Henry VIII. He will shower you with honours, promotions. You'll be everything, but very briefly, because Henry loves the thrill of the chase and he quickly grows bored. And that's what happens. Mary has discarded her reputation pretty much in ruins. So that was a pivotal influence on her sister Anne. There's no way Anne is going to agree to be Henry's mistress after seeing what happened to her sister.
So once Henry becomes so obsessed with Anne, Anne becomes very calculating, correct? How does she play the game?
Would we call it the rules where, you're kind of playing hard to get? I think we would. And we get this from Henry's love letters. So we have 17 of them surviving in the Vatican archives, intriguingly. We don't have Anne's letters to Henry, really frustratingly, but we have his to hers. And what we can glean from that is that Anne is really playing hard to get and she's not giving Henry what he wants. And you sense his increasing frustration. And he's like a lovesick teenager. I've seen these letters in the flesh. I was lucky enough to go over to Rome and see them in the Vatican. And he's drawing love hearts around her initials and basically begging her, please be my mistress, be my only mistress. He thinks that's such an honour. I'm not going to see any other woman but you. And Anne just keeps saying no. And that word no holds so much power because it really propels Henry forward to do the unthinkable and set aside his loyal, much-loved first wife, Catherine of Aragon, so that he can marry Anne Boleyn. And he proposes this to Anne as early as 1527, so a year into their kind of courtship. And Anne takes him seriously, I think, from then. That's I think, when it becomes quite real for Anne. I think Henry is a bit of an irritation before then. She doesn't want to be pestered to be a mistress. But when he starts talking of marriage, I think that's something very different.
Did Anne want the power of being queen? And if she did, what do you think she wanted to do with it?
Oh, the multi-million dollar question. Because what did Anne set out for this from the very beginning? Is that why she tortured Henry playing hard to get, because she had her eyes on the prize? I find that difficult. I think more that Anne was swept along by events. But then when it began to be seen as kind of inevitable that she was going to be queen or that she could be queen, I think she resolved that she was going to make the most of it because she had these burning ambitions for England and for religion. And she knew that being queen was a position of incredible power. So this was her chance to put all of her ideas into practice. So for Anne, I don't believe it was love at any stage. And I don't believe she plotted for the throne from the beginning, but I do believe she came to that idea eventually. And she came to realize just how much she could do with that position.
Now, once she's married to Henry, how did she then influence the court? And did the court see her differently now that she's married to Henry and she's the queen?
The court never liked Anne Boleyn. So we need to be clear about that. Henry, of course, adored Anne, but she was despised universally, pretty much. She was called the great whore, the concubine. People loved Catherine of Aragon. They saw her as the true queen. They really admired Catherine's principled stand against Henry. She carried on insisting she was Henry's true wife. She wasn't going to give up without a fight. And they saw Anne as just this usurper. So they hated her, but Anne was made of pretty strong stuff and she was ready to take them on. And she had what she believed was going to be the superpower because she was already pregnant by the time she married Henry VIII in January 1533. And of course, she was confident it was going to be a son because that's what Henry needed. And we haven't said this really, but it was a really important point that Catherine of Aragon, great and loyal wife though she'd been, hadn't given Henry a son, and Henry was desperate for a male heir. So this was a real driver for him in marrying Anne Boleyn. And if she had had a son who had survived, all of those critics would have been silenced for good. Anne would have been forever protected and hailed as the rightful Queen of England. But as we know, it wasn't a boy that Anne was carrying. It was the future Elizabeth I.
I think that is just so fascinating. Could you talk a little bit about the pressure that now we're talking about Anne as a mother? We're sort of transitioning into this. Can you talk about the pressure that would have been on her either during the pregnancy to deliver a boy, but then also afterwards when it wasn't a boy? What was Henry's reaction? What was the court's reaction? And what was Anne's reaction?
Well, the latter was very different to the rest. So, yeah, the pressure was intense. Anne knew she had to literally deliver as Henry's new wife. He'd gone to all of this trouble in order to marry her. You know, breaking from Rome, changing the religion, creating a new Church of England, all for Anne Boleyn so she could give him a son. So the pressure was intense. And at the first attempt, anyway, Anne had failed in Henry's eyes, and he was crushed with disappointment because he already had a daughter. Catherine of Aragon had given him one of those, the Princess Mary, so he didn't need another, he needed a son. And I think Anne's enemies, of which there were many, rejoiced at her failure. But Anne herself never showed even the slightest hint of disappointment at the birth of her daughter. In fact, she doted on Elizabeth from the very beginning. She couldn't bear to be apart from her. She would have her placed on velvet cushions next to her throne when she was conducting court business. She tried to breastfeed Elizabeth herself, which we might think, so what? That was shocking. Royal mothers did not do that. And Henry in the end stepped in and said, you know, that was not allowed. And one scandalized ambassador said, day and night, she will not let this daughter of hers out of her sight. This was unusual. We might not think so today. Of course, you will want to be with your new baby. Not in the Tudor times. If you're a member of the royal family, your baby becomes pretty much a stranger to you from the very beginning. They're packed off to the royal nursery and raised by wet nurses and governesses. And then you're on with the business of conceiving again. But this was different. Anne clearly adored Elizabeth, and I think a very strong bond was forged between them, even at this very early stage.
You know what I find so fascinating and shocking about all of this is it seems so much of your position in court, your position as a woman, your position, frankly, in life, depended on what religion you were and what your body would or would not do.
Yes, it's so much, so much. And in the end, Anne, and indeed Elizabeth, although to a lesser extent, was judged by her body, not by her brilliant mind. And as a royal consort, that was your number one job. You had to fill that royal nursery, and almost nothing else mattered, really.
Now, it also seems, and you talk about this in the book, and I just felt the pain throughout all of this, enormous pressure back on Anne now to produce a boy. And it appears that she miscarried several times or had pregnancies that did not come to term. That must have been so devastating for her. And it also, at what point was really her fate sealed in all of this?
You're right. We think that Anne suffered three miscarriages after Elizabeth. She was pregnant again just 3 months after Elizabeth's birth. So she knew the pressure was on. And there is a theory that actually Henry may have had, now I might get this wrong, but Kell's syndrome, where a man can have a healthy child with a woman, but only one healthy child, and the rest will be miscarriages. And that kind of works with Henry's history with his wife. So I think that probably was what happened. It was happening, even though Anne, of course, got all the blame. But the rot set in very quickly for Henry. He was this great hunter, as I said. He wanted what he couldn't have. And as soon as he had Anne, even before she'd had Elizabeth, there's a sense of, oh, she's just a woman like all the others. And he starts to distance himself from her. He starts to see other women. And then she has the miscarriages. And the situation just goes from bad to worse for poor Anne. And it's the last of those miscarriages that really seals her fate. In January 1536, on the same day that her old rival, Catherine of Aragon, is buried in Peterborough Cathedral, Anne miscarries. And a member of the court remarks she has miscarried of her saviour. This was really the last throw of the dice for Anne. And I think it's a turning point for Henry. Historians always shy away from using the phrase turning point, but I think it's true in this case. I think Henry has just given up now. He said, I see God will give me no male children from this marriage, or words to that effect. So almost certainly he privately instructs Thomas Cromwell to get him out of this marriage. And the problem for Anne is that Cromwell is gunning for her anyway, because they're sworn enemies. So Cromwell is going to make sure he gets rid of Anne for good.
Following Anne's execution, which really came only a few months later, what happens to Elizabeth? Because this issue of legitimacy and who's going to take over the throne, this was not a given for Elizabeth by any means. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's so interesting. I know we've spoken about this before, but looking at the history of the monarchy, often it's those who were never supposed to come to the throne who make the best job of it. And we can say that about Elizabeth, because at the time of Anne's execution, she stood no hope of ever being queen. Her parents' marriage had been annulled just before her mother was executed, which meant that Elizabeth was illegitimate. And so she was banished from court. Henry didn't want any reminders of Anne Boleyn, of his disastrous second marriage. Elizabeth was coming to physically resemble her mother. And of course, her very existence reminded Henry of Anne Boleyn. So he didn't really want Elizabeth at court. And she became very close to the women in her household. And those women had been chosen by her mother, Anne Boleyn. So Elizabeth grew up surrounded by Boleyn relatives, Boleyn associates. I think it was one of the best things Anne did in appointing the servants to her tiny daughter, as she was then, because it made sure that Elizabeth grew up with a very positive impression of her late mother. And that was crucial, because the rest of the country had no such impression. So if Elizabeth had been raised in any other household, she would have probably grown up hating Anne Boleyn and believing that she was a concubine and that she'd had adulterous relationships with these five men who'd been executed with her. But Elizabeth grew up with a very different view. And it becomes obvious when she approaches her teenage years that she's kind of obsessed with her late mother. And what she's obsessed with is trying to rehabilitate her. Clearly, Elizabeth doesn't believe that her mother had been guilty. And she wants to rebuild her mother's shattered reputation. And what we now know is she will spend the rest of her life trying to do that.
I find that so interesting. And we have talked a little bit about that, but I'd love to talk some more about that from the moment of Elizabeth I's coronation. She's sending messages to the public about her mother, correct?
Oh, she is. And this is one of my favorite moments, because on the whole, Elizabeth is quite subtle in her support of her mother. She's not subtle at her coronation. She has a life-size model of Anne Boleyn on the processional route in this sort of glorious family tree that's crafted with all of these huge kind of platforms, and Elizabeth herself, there's a model of her on the top platform, and then underneath her, her parents. So you'd expect her to, you know, really point attention to the fact she's Henry VIII's daughter, because nobody's going to question his legitimacy. But there, on that second tier, right next to Henry VIII, is that life-size model of Anne Boleyn. And throughout the coronation, which was modelled on Anne Boleyn's, I should say, you see her emblems, the famous falcon, the white falcon of Anne Boleyn. And Elizabeth wears the same crown that her mother had used for her coronation. So the whole event is really to honour her late mother.
And with that, Tracy and I are going to take a brief break, but we'll be back to continue the story.
Summer, the best time of year, usually doesn't come with a great deal. Soaring temperatures come with soaring prices. But what if there's another way? With IKEA, your summer plans can last longer than 2 weeks of vacation and be more affordable. Here, everyone can have lounge chair access, no reservations needed. From affordable outdoor furniture to stylish accessories, we have all the essentials you need to soak up summer in style, no matter the size of your space. Start planning a better summer with IKEA. It's your outdoor dreams inside your budget.
And we're back. I'm Carl Raymond, host of the Gilded Gentleman History Podcast. And today I'm with author and royal historian Tracy Borman, and we are looking at royal mothers and daughters. Now, even though they really barely knew each other, Elizabeth wasn't even 3 years old at her mother's execution, what, in your opinion, did Anne most instill in Elizabeth as a legacy? What did she pass on to her daughter?
Oh, gosh, so much. It's hard to kind of pinpoint just one thing, because there are the sort of psychological factors, such as Elizabeth deciding to remain the Virgin Queen, which I think we can ascribe first and foremost to Anne. It's not a great advert for marriage if your father orders your mother's execution, really. But as well, Anne had blazed a trail for queens. Now, admittedly, she was a queen consort. Elizabeth was a queen regnant. She ruled. But Anne had been a woman in a man's world, just like Elizabeth. And she had been an absolute firecracker. You know, she had expressed views that shocked society, shocked the court. She hadn't been prepared to just accept that women were second-class citizens. And I think if she'd had that son, her influence would have been boundless. But of course, she had the daughter, who actually turned out to be the triumph of Henry's dynasty. But I do think it's in just that, providing this inspirational role model of female authority in a male-dominated world, I think that was Anne's greatest legacy to her daughter.
Now, there are two details that you share in talks and in discussions of your work that I just find truly astonishing. One is the checkers ring, and the second is a very small detail on Elizabeth's tomb that perhaps only she knew was actually there. So can you talk about both of these? Let's talk about the checkers ring, if you can explain what this is and why it's important.
Yeah, the checkers ring has to be my favorite survivor from Elizabeth's reign. And it's a tiny locket ring. We call it the checkers ring, by the way, because Checkers House is the British Prime Minister's country residence, and there the ring is kept. And it's a tiny locket ring, so fragile. I've held it, and I couldn't fit it on any of my fingers, because Elizabeth and Anne Boleyn were very proud of their long, slender fingers. And let's just say their fingers are a lot more slender than mine, because I couldn't even get it on my little finger. So they weren't wrong. And it's on the face of the ring is an ER in diamond, Elizabeth Regina. But it opens up to reveal two portraits, one of Elizabeth and the other almost certainly of Anne Boleyn. Why almost? Well, she looks exactly like Anne Boleyn. She has the French hood, the same features, face shape, but she has fair hair. So that's why the doubt, because Anne Boleyn was famously dark-haired. But recent analysis has shown dark flecks little flecks of dark enamel that probably wore off over the years. So I think that lady had originally been dark-haired, but it faded. And in my mind, it has to be Anne. It doesn't make sense for it to be anybody else. This locket ring dates from the 1570s. So when Elizabeth had been queen for, you know, getting on for 20 years, we don't know who commissioned it, whether it was Elizabeth herself or perhaps one of her close favourites who knew what her mother meant to her. But it became one of her most prized possessions, and she kept this ring with her until the day she died.
And let's talk about Elizabeth I's tomb. What can one... This was such a revelation to me when you first said this. What did she perhaps intend, and one can see if one looks very carefully?
Well, yes, one can see, and it's worth a look. If any of your listeners head to London anytime soon, do go to Westminster Abbey, because frankly, it's an amazing place to visit anyway, and Elizabeth's tomb is just incredible. But if you peer very closely, you will see a tiny carved falcon. So the Anne Boleyn falcon. And this really, for me, is so poignant because Elizabeth is honouring her mother even after her death. This is a symbol that becomes increasingly prevalent at Elizabeth's court, the falcon, as her reign wears on. And in death, Anne Boleyn is still there, proudly displayed. It takes some finding, I have to say, but it's well worth a look.
So now, Tracy, you know that my trademark Gilded Gentleman question is always asking guests what they would have asked themselves of these historical figures. Were they sitting with us? And you have certainly answered that question in our last show. But I want to flip that a little bit. And I'd like to ask you, what do you think Elizabeth I would have most wanted to know from her mother? And what would she have wanted to ask Anne herself?
Yeah, that is such a great question. I think what she would have wanted to ask Anne is, why did you marry my father? And, you know, genuinely, why did you marry Henry VIII? Did you love him? Did you have ambitions for being queen and for shaping the country? Did you have no choice in the matter? And I think it's probably one of the number one questions that we have as well. But I do think Elizabeth would have been fascinated to know that the answer to that.
So in this section, I'd like to briefly touch on two more slightly modern mother-daughter relationships. And one is that of Queen Victoria and her mother, the Duchess of Kent. And then two, the relationship between Queen Elizabeth II and her mother, known to many of us as the Queen Mother, the former Lady Elizabeth Bowes Lyon. And what is so interesting, and Tracy mentioned this in our conversation about Anne and Elizabeth, is that in so many of these cases, neither mother ever thought she was going to be the mother of a queen, and the queens never thought they were really going to become queen at all. So let's start with Queen Victoria. So in the case of Victoria, can you give us a little sense of who her mother was? Because I think to many listeners, this will not be known. And when I was digging into this, again, to prepare the show, I was astonished. This seems to be a tale of widowhood and estranged wives and a really messy succession, right? Can you talk about that? And who was Victoria's mother and how did this all come to be?
It was very messy. You're absolutely right. Victoria's mother was a German princess, Victoria of Saxe-Coburg-Saalfeld. And I apologize for the lack of German accent in that. And she married George III's fourth son, Edward, Duke of Kent. Now, George III was this bastion of morality. He very happily married Queen Charlotte. They had 15 children, 15 legitimate children, many sons. But unfortunately, their sons didn't really like to follow suit. They preferred mistresses to wives. And so this prompted a succession crisis, really, because you would think George III was safe in, you know, certainly there's going to be plenty of successors for years to come. I've produced all these children, but no. So you get what's known as the baby race, because suddenly his sons realize they're going to have to get on with it and start marrying and producing legitimate heirs. The eldest son, George, the Prince Regent, had produced a daughter, but she died. And really, it was her death that prompted this crisis in the royal family. So Edward, Duke of Kent, he quickly got married to this German princess, Victoria, and he was quickest off the mark. They had a child, Victoria, the following year in 1819. Victoria was born at Kensington Palace. She wasn't called Victoria, by the way. That was just her second name. Her first name was Alexandrina, and she was known as Drina for much of her childhood, but she became known by the same name as her mother, Victoria. Well, her father, Edward Duke of Kent, died just a few months after Victoria's birth. And so she was largely raised by her mother, the Duchess of Kent, and also by the Duchess's reviled favourite, Sir John Conroy, who was Victoria's father's servant, and then he became quite a dominant influence in Victoria's childhood. And if you believe Victoria herself, then she had a miserable childhood that was very suffocating, and she was allowed no freedom, and she was never allowed to be on her own. But I think she over-egged it a bit, because, you know, reading her childhood diaries, she had a nice time. She had a lot of pets and seaside holidays and carriage rides around Kensington Gardens, and she was spoilt rotten. But I think the more obvious it became that none of George III's other sons were going to produce a legitimate heir, therefore it was going to go to Victoria, the more restrictive her childhood became, I think.
So do you think it's fair to say she had a difficult or challenging relationship with her mother growing up?
Yes, very much so. The early years, not so much, and her mother doted on her, but increasingly when Conroy's influence came to the fore, it really jaundiced Victoria's view of her mother, and they clashed a lot. And I think it's very telling that one of the first things Victoria decided when she became queen at the age of 18 is that she was going to leave Kensington Palace. The system that her mother and Conroy had devised to kind of shape her into a future queen was known as the Kensington system. And Victoria deeply resented her mother for that and pretty much abandoned her. She did see her mother thereafter, but she could not wait to get out of her clutches, as she saw it. And it took a long time for them to be even on speaking terms again. They did restore some of their former affection, but it was never quite the same.
So the Duchess of Kent dies in 1861. So did Victoria's image of her mother change after her mother's death? Did anything shift?
Yes, big, big shift. The death of her mother had a profound impact on Victoria, even though there'd been all this resentment building up in her since childhood. She was grief-stricken at the loss of her mother and never really got over it, particularly as not long afterwards she lost her beloved husband, Prince Albert, and then her grief spiraled to irreversible depths. And of course, that's how we know Victoria dressed in her mourning clothes, and she pretty much retires from public duties. And it's almost like she, when she lost her mother, she got back in touch with the mother she had loved in early childhood, but had lost sight of. So it's really poignant, actually, for poor Victoria. It was such a sad time in her life.
I think that's interesting because we think so much of the effect that, of course, the death of Prince Albert had on her. But I think many listeners may not realize that that really fell on the heels of the death of her mother. So this poor woman was dealing really for the rest of her life with two significant losses in really in quick succession.
And she never really did come to terms with either. And yeah, it was. You know, we talk about that. Elizabeth II is often quoted as saying, you know, the annus horribilis, the awful year, the horrible year. That was 1861 for poor Victoria, losing her mother and her husband.
So, Tracy, can you offer any comment as to then Victoria's own influence on her own five daughters?
Yeah. Interesting. I think a modern day psychoanalyst would have a field day with these relationships because, you know, Victoria had nine children in total, but she hated being pregnant and she didn't really like children very much either. So she had an unusual relationship with her children and with her daughters. Now, the best, I think the healthiest relationship, mother-daughter, was with her eldest child, Vicky, another Victoria. And I think, you know, Victoria was quoted as saying, you know, if only Vicky could be queen after me, rather than Bertie, her eldest son, who Victoria didn't have a high opinion of. But the mother-daughter relationships weren't always so positive with Victoria. And she seems to have been, interestingly, quite a suffocating mother, in the same way she accused her own mother of being, and really didn't like her daughters leaving home, flying the nest, living their own lives. And particularly her youngest daughter, Beatrice, who she pretty much told from birth, you're staying with me. You know, this is the daughter I'm keeping all to myself. Well, eventually Beatrice fell in love and begged her mother that she might marry. And Victoria agreed, but only on condition that the newlyweds would actually live with her. And I love the fact Victoria turned up in the middle of their honeymoon. So it's like mother-in-law from hell. Poor Beatrice and her husband. So she was quite a cloying influence at her worst over her daughters, I think.
Now, Tracy, just to round out our talk today about royal mothers and daughters, and boy, we've covered a spectrum, but I'd like to very briefly address Queen Elizabeth II and her mother, the former queen consort, and of course, Lady Elizabeth Bowes Lyon. Now, again, neither woman ever expected to be queen, but all that changed, of course, in 1936 with the abdication of Edward VIII. Do you have any thoughts about that relationship, Queen Elizabeth II and her mother?
Yeah, I mean, we ironically, the more modern royals, we know less about their personal relationships in a way, because they haven't necessarily left behind a paper trail or eyewitness accounts in the same way as when the royal court was much more public place. Yet, having said that, we know enough, I think, to know that this was a very close relationship between Elizabeth II and her mother. There's a lovely little vignette described when Elizabeth's father has just taken the throne when his brother Edward VIII abdicated unexpectedly. And she sees a letter in the hall of their Piccadilly home, Piccadilly, a part of London, and it's addressed to Her Majesty the Queen. And Elizabeth says, "That's mummy now, isn't it?" And it's sort of a real moment where she realises, oh, everything's changed. Well, I think this relationship between mother and daughter was pivotal in Elizabeth II's life. And I think one of the greatest lessons that Elizabeth learned from her mother was duty. This became her watchword. So her father had definitely not wanted to be king, but he did his duty. He wanted to secure the rocking throne, as he put it. And so Elizabeth Bowes Lyon, his wife, absolutely supported him every inch of the way. And she passed on that sense of duty to her daughter. And she was there in the background in her daughter's reign throughout, all the way up until her death. And the grief that Elizabeth II felt upon the loss of her mother was all too obvious at the time. And you know, she'd lost her sister Margaret quite recently. So it was a very sad time. But her mother had been a very, very positive influence in really instilling in Elizabeth II, you know, this is what you do. And I think we see this in particular during the war, during World War II, when the king, Elizabeth II's father, famously refuses to go into safety, but he stays in Windsor and spends a lot of time in London, almost risking, you know, his life when Buckingham Palace is bombed. And Elizabeth Bowes Lyon famously says, when asked, why aren't you sending your daughters, Elizabeth and Margaret, to Canada, as was proposed for their safety? She said, "The children won't go without me. I won't leave without the king, and the king will never leave." So that sense, you will stay and you will do your duty. And goodness me, did Elizabeth II live that?
It's such a fascinating image of the Queen Mother, that sort of cheerfulness, but that steely resolve. And,
yes.
And it does seem that it was passed on to Elizabeth II, right?
I really do think it was. I think she was an enormous influence on her daughter. And the fact that she was there for, you know, a huge part of her daughter's reign, you know, 50 years or more, is quite extraordinary. And I think Elizabeth II must have confided in her mother an awful lot, sought her advice. She trusted her. She respected her. It does seem to have been such a positive relationship in Elizabeth II's life.
So, Tracy, gosh, we have focused really predominantly in our chat today on, as you say in the title of your book, The Mother and Daughter That Changed History. Of course, Anne Boleyn and Elizabeth I, but also in the reigns of both Queen Victoria and Queen Elizabeth II. Do you see any influences, either conscious or maybe unconscious, on these more contemporary queens that might have come from our Tudor mother-daughter pair?
I do, actually. Elizabeth II, interestingly, spoke about this, and she completely denied that there was any influence from the first Elizabeth. There was a lot of talk when Elizabeth II came to the throne in 1952 of a second Elizabethan age. And she said, "I don't feel I've got anything in common with the first Elizabeth. She was a despot. She never left England's shores." And Elizabeth II, of course, famously was the most travelled monarch, apart from anything else. But they had things in common. And I think Victoria and Elizabeth II had a lot to thank Elizabeth I and Anne Boleyn for, because they'd been trailblazers and they had carved out a position for both Queen's consort and Queen's regnant. Elizabeth I in particular had made England fall in love with queens. Before then, they were seen as a disaster. You would only have a woman on the throne if it was the absolute last resort. And now all of that has changed. And Elizabeth II actually changed the laws of succession so that women now have equal precedence with men in the line of succession, which is a huge change. But it all started with these two original trailblazers, Anne Boleyn and her daughter Elizabeth.
Oh gosh, Tracy, we could just go on and on. And I'm so looking forward. Gosh, will you come back on the show?
Please, anytime. You know, it's always both the happiest and the fastest hour of my week. So yes, please.
But I think we have covered and uncovered a lot today in looking at certainly some destiny-changing mother and daughter relationships. Now, are you working on a new book?
I am. I'm delighted to say I'm working on another nonfiction book. Then I'm turning back to fiction for a while. And it's going to be out in fall 25, I think. So I've got a big writing year this year. I can't quite reveal the subject yet, but I can say it's Tudor. And I can say it's one of my favorite characters of all time.
Well, we'll just have to guess who that might be. And I sort of can guess, but we'll just wait in anticipation. And when you come out with that book, please come back on The Gilded Gentleman. My listeners would love to hear you more. And so would I.
Thank you. I will be back like a shot.
Thank you, Tracy, so much for joining me today on The Gilded Gentleman. It is always such a pleasure to talk with you, either on or off mic. I'm so grateful. Thank you so much.
Such a pleasure. Thanks so much, Cole.
And to my listeners, if you haven't read Tracy's book, Anne Boleyn and Elizabeth I, The Mother and Daughter Who Forever Changed History, I encourage you to find a copy today wherever books are sold, and to follow Tracy on Instagram at tracy.borman and through her website, tracyborman.co.uk. And just keep watch for another book. And thank you for joining me for another episode of The Gilded Gentleman. The Gilded Gentleman is produced by Bowery Boys Media, and this episode was edited and produced by Kieran Gannon. To stay up to date on upcoming podcasts, special tours, and events, make sure to sign up for The Gilded Gentleman monthly newsletter, and you can do that on thegildedgentleman.com. I invite my listeners to become patrons of the show on patreon.com/thegildedgentleman. Your support helps me to manage the costs of researching, writing, creating, and producing the show. I couldn't do it without you. And I'll see you soon. And after all, what's life without a little glint of gold?